Part 7, Chapter 7. It was a startling sight. The grandeur of the scene in this thin, cold air made one feel small. Out of a river, a thin silver thread in the depths far below reared a reddish, massive wall of rock rising sheer and raw. Narrowly across from it was its echoing face.
Down through the eons, the river, finding a softer strata between the two faces, had gnawed and gnawed its turbulent way to make at last this gigantic knife slice in the all but impregnable stone.
1,000 feet deep, 100 yards wide, the enormous wound gaped. All around it rose majestic peaks, hiding it from the world. The sparkling white line of quartz, many feet thick, marked it with a brief diagonal line. And in that quartz, embedded and pure, gold shone and beckoned. It had, in its reality, a much greater impact than any photograph. It was like a jewel band set upon the wrinkled skin of a hag. One could see far below where a portion of the cliff face had fallen. The fragments lay like crashed pebbles in the depths. The river had eaten too deep under the cliff, and an earthquake had shaken a slice of the face loose. Snow had not fallen yet, for the year was dry, and there was nothing to impede the view. Johnny dropped the plane lower, and then the wind hit them. Funneled up the long gorge, compressed and screaming to get free, the turbulent currents tore at the cliff. With fingers racing across the over-large keys of the console, Johnny fought to keep the light personnel plane in position. It was not a dazzling load at that moment. It was a brutal, elemental wall that could crush them if they touched it. Johnny leaped the plane 1,000 feet up, clear of the updrafts, and steadied it. He turned to one of the Scots, the one who looked like him and who had spoken of burns. His name was Dunaldine McSwanson.
Can you handle this plane?
Dunaldine came forward. Robert the Fox went to a rear seat, and Dunaldine strapped himself into the co-pilot seat. In these teleportation drives, there were a number of corrections that had to be constantly watched. Some were built into the computers. Some were pre-programmed for any flight. Space itself was absolute and motionless, having no time, energy, or mass of its own. But to stay in one place relative to the mass around one, it was necessary to parallel its track. The world turned daily, and that was a near 1,000-mile-an-hour correction. Earth orbited the sun, and that required second-to-second correction. The solar system was precessing, and even if the correction was minute, it had to be compensated for. The whole solar system was en route to somewhere else at a blinding speed. The universe itself was twisting in relation to other universes. These factors and others made control of the ship a dicey business in normal times. Down there in that canyon, it was a nightmare. The irregular external buffetings of the wind upset the inertia of the motor housing and made instant shifts of coordination continual.